We're thinking of finding hooks, hooks that are built into the structure of law that, one, create normative demands in terms of human rights, but also create structural inclusion. And we're looking, and I think it was really helpful that Phil said MMT isn't normative and didn't say that it was neutral. Because MMT is not neutral. Neutrality is one of those false things that we have been taught to think exists, right? But it can be used in normatively lots of different ways. And so connecting back to this idea that we use the economic theory to, and Scott Fullweather said this yesterday, like blow open the world of possibility, and then we come back to law and think about how we structure that and where we can get some normative claims. With those, like, super structurally, I don't know why I keep saying that word. With those takeaways, let's open it up. Oh, sorry. The ground rules for opening it up. We've got a lot of people in the room. We want to hear as many voices as possible, so keep that in mind. And then if Raul or Lua give you an interesting nod, that might be thank you. Let's hear some.
I'll speak once in that case.
And I'll try to give this to folks so we can hear them.
I'm Bob Kraft. Thank you all for your very insightful comments. I was especially interested in Phil's observations about the empirical and the normative spheres of MMT. And in particular, when it comes to the normative sphere, that question of where the money comes from and then where it goes. As long as these two questions are linked together, there's not going to be any way forward, right? So what MMT can help us with is understanding that there is this real possibility of essentially a free lunch. I know that's a very charged term, but there really is, frankly. But how the money is going to be spent is a function of the political discourse, part of the narrative. But as long as the spending question is tied up with, you know, what's the source of the funds, we're not going to have a rational discourse about it. See? So it seems to me that the economic sphere can help us with the first question. The second one, how it's going to be spent, this is a question for the political dialogue. And that's the one that should come first. We should decide as a society what it is we want to look like, and then we can figure out how to put it together. And I wonder if you might have a reaction to that observation.
Can we get a few things out in the floor, and then we'll come back? I'm taking little notes to make sure that we don't forget what we heard. Jim? I'm going to say Jim, and then next to you, and then yes.
I was really glad to hear Phil's comments and his perspective, because it's the first time that I've seen really kind of looking at what are the political constraints. How are we going to get this passed? And most of the things that I've heard sound very, very liberal. And I know a lot of conservatives, and they're going to be scared away by the rhetoric or the arguments. And like Stephanie Kelton said yesterday, you have to know your audience and who you're trying to win over. Because I think conservatives can be won over to the argument if you speak in their language. If you give them something that they're probably not going to be sold on this jobs or right. They're going to be more sold on people should be working because that's what they're supposed to be doing. And maybe buying more into some of the more neoclassical arguments that these kinds of things can actually help the economy. It's good for the economy. It's good for the private sector. It's good for the market. If you can make those kinds of arguments, you can win over some conservatives. Because ultimately, if the election could go great in November, there's still going to be Republican votes that are necessary in order to pass this. Or pass some version of it. And in the area of budget and finance, we have something called the foot in the door strategy, where you try to get something started, not ideal in terms of what you exactly want it to be, but once you get started, you can build upon it. And then just in terms of how we're going to pay for it question, I think Republicans are very, very good at coming up with catchphrases that stick in people's minds. And whether or not they're true, or how much they're backed up by data, doesn't always matter, at least to the core supporters. So you take something out of their playbook, where you say, well, when it comes to the tax cut, how are you going to pay for it? They're going to pay for themselves in the long run. Well, how's the job guarantee going to work? It's going to pay for itself in the long run. And come up with several arguments about how that is going to occur, how it's going to create a stronger economy, how it's going to create more productivity, and those sorts of things. And in the long run, pays for itself.
Brad.
I'm going to take this round, get some feedback to it, and then come in and unless you tell me.
Just everyone, please remember that we have a constrained amount of time. We're out here to work.
We can give them this other.
My question is for the panel. How do you expect to defend a job guarantee in the courts once it ever does get passed? So the most rosy scenario, I would think, is after the 2020 election. So say 2021 in the spring or the summer, possibly that Congress could pass a job guarantee legislation and signed by a new president. With the direction the court has been going, I think it's inevitable that some states, perhaps in the South or the Midwest, could challenge the law and try to get it thrown out, or unconstitutional perhaps. Have you guys thought of any way of defending this new right to your job? What's the strategy, or what's the strategy on the other side, or what's their case of why it could be unconstitutional in their view, and what's our case of why it is fundamentally a human right to be constitutional?
Shifting slightly to more conceptual ideas, and particularly on the issue of human rights, and I think I want to ask Jonathan about this. There's a growing body of literature critiquing the notion of human rights, which has emerged particularly in post-World War II era, and it's critiquing on the grounds of a too impoverished idea of human rights, of freedoms from certain things, but without any provisions for an economic aspect of human rights. But it sounds very much like what you're proposing is an economic side of the human rights. How are you confronting this, particularly confronting like this impoverished idea of human rights, and are we trying to change the conception of what human rights is to include the rights to certain economic aspects?
Is that any questions for that?
Yeah, so what I'm gonna do is allow people up here very, very, very brief responses. If anybody has something that they want to add to what we just heard, I'll give you a chance for that, and then we'll open for a whole new round.
Sean,
can you make
a call? I'll grab that mic.
Oh, sorry.
So, quick response on your question. First of all, so not everyone in the room is from the U.S., so there's sort of I'll give a sort of multifaceted answer. The US is like way behind the curve on this kind of thinking. And when you go to other countries around the world, it's a completely different situation. So I completely agree with the critiques that human rights is impoverished, both extremely much so in the United States and globally as well. The critiques are also critiquing the global human rights system. But when we talk about human rights in the US, we often use that interchangeably with civil rights, and it's looking at a sort of narrow basket of civil rights as you're pointing out. But elsewhere in the world, in the European system, the Inter-American system, and African system, and countries have signed up to a whole host of economic rights treaties, it's seen much broader. And so elsewhere in the world, this isn't as much of a problem, but there is still impoverishment you're talking about. So this is really a specific US problem of how do we get a broader view of rights. Part of this is like the United States, it's appalling when you actually realize there's a whole host of human rights treaties which have their own problems, but the US hasn't even signed up to them. But we haven't gotten a state that we're like a party to them. So there's a treaty on economic, social, and cultural rights. We're not a party to that. There's a treaty on women's rights. The United States is not a party to that. Almost every country in the world is. There's a children's rights treaty. And literally every single country in the world is a party to the children's rights treaty, which also includes economic rights for children and like housing rights and schooling rights. And only the United States is not a party. There used to be Somalia and South Sudan were a party, but they recently signed up, so now the US is not a party. So we're sitting behind, like the existing system is impoverished and has its own problems, but we're even behind that minimum threshold level. So I mean, this is a huge problem. So it's a longer term education. First of all, it's education. And other legal systems, you have to take some human rights law to become a lawyer. So I mean, you're getting an LLB in the UK, at least you're getting like previously at least EU law, and there's human rights components to that that's required. At the College of William & Mary, it's one of the oldest law schools. I looked at it historically, the curriculum, there was like a document from like late 1700s, the curricula then of what you was required to get a law degree included law of nations, so it studied international law. Today, that's not part of the curriculum. So you can become a lawyer in the United States without ever having studied international law, without ever having studied human rights law. So lots of people go through without even being exposed to like these broader issues. And then you come, then that produces the legal system and judges. So this is a massive US specific problem that requires education and social movements.
Let me make a quick comment to kind of tie things together just a little bit. One is that, you know, this criticism of rights, I think, is extremely important to take seriously and to address. And I tried to touch on it a little bit yesterday in my remarks. There are radical critiques of rights, right? And they're especially popular in the late 80s and early 90s within the Legal Academy. And I myself have gone back and forth with a lot of critical legal scholars, like John Haskell at Manchester, about whether we should even be framing this in terms of rights in the first place. And ultimately, I come back to Patricia Williams' point that she made and the alchemy of race and rights. At the end of the day, you can describe means for oppressed people and any damn thing can happen, right? And you have to mobilize and you have to actually make that claim, and otherwise we're in trouble. And we can, people should talk about that. I can't talk about that. Yeah, and sure. So as far as the constitutionality goes, I think that, you know, we have to be very careful with legislation. Perhaps Phil can speak more to that. I would say generally we can expect, of course, commerce clause arguments, taxation arguments, those sorts of things. What's really important, I think, is to get into the legislation, get its enforcement provision, and have it in ways that judges can effectively constitutionalize the program based on the criteria that are provided in the legislation. That's a different question a little bit than defending against the tax, but ultimately this comes down to the question of design and how people are sort of talking about these sorts of things. The last thing I just wanted to note is to tie in, I think, some of the folks, the things that were said at the beginning of the opening part is there are obviously respectful disagreements about how to fund things. Phil and Rowan and I don't necessarily see eye to eye on certain things, although we were hashing it out. Personally, I think, as I said yesterday, that politically we have to get over the taxpayer money frame. It's going to be extremely, extremely difficult to convince, especially particular sections of the U.S. electorate, that they need to pay for rights out of their pocket, especially with black and brown people on the margins. Of course, there are disadvantages to that approach. Trust funds are attractive for, you know, specific reasons, but just want to kind of highlight there are multiple sides to this debate here.
I actually, just putting that out there, I keep talking a lot about incrementalism, whereas right, Phil talked about something for 100 years, because I don't think the 100-year strategy is rights. The rights strategy is mired, and there's Martha Feynman and Martha McCluskey. Actually, Martha McCluskey, who is at SUNY Buffalo, and I are basically now the two people in the world who are working at the intersection of MMT and this political theory called vulnerability theory. And what vulnerability theory is trying to do is get beyond rights-based, groups-based frameworks, because our current system of rights, even when it's not impoverished, is fundamentally mired in a competition. We have created markets for rights where people are trying to control those valuable resources. Politically, and this is really important, and Phil was talking about this, politically, you have to, that's a very powerful discourse today. I think where we want to be in 100 years is where we have reclaimed and renegotiated what rights means, so it's not we need rights for brown people or women, because so long as white people have to give something to me, it's going to be this competition. And when it's for everybody, I think it will look different, but right, we are not in the moment where All Lives Matter is a thing that people want to be a part of. So there's a evolution, and people are in different places. I want to give this to Phil, and I see you, and then I'll open it to you.
I'm going to try to respond to the questions in the order in which they were asked. And I forgot a little bit of the points you made, so forgive me if I'm a little
off. Some notes.
Okay. Another thing that I think that MMT theory has had an unfortunate effect is that it's underappreciated the importance of looking at the savings that a job guarantee would create. My research actually on what we now call a job guarantee began with that question. It was back in 1982-83, and I was talking with my brother who was a city manager. I wonder what it would cost, and that was the middle of depression, point recession, 10% unemployment. I wonder what it would cost to just create jobs for all the unemployed. And that was the beginning. And the next 6 years of my life were spent sort of trying to figure that out. Questions eventually published in a 1989 book. And what I find in modeling a program from 1977 to 1986 that provided a very generous job guarantee was that 60% of the total cost would be accounted for in direct program savings in other benefits, unemployment insurance, et cetera. 20% of program costs would be covered by the taxes that program participants pay. And so all we had to worry about, well, funding 20%, but that didn't take into account any of the indirect savings, didn't take into account the savings attributable to reduced rates of physical and mental illness, family disruption, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And crucially, it didn't take into account the anti-cyclical effects of a job guarantee. In fact, in that 10-year period, the remaining 20% deficit was entirely attributable to the recession years of 81 to 83. So if that recession had moderated, the 20% would have come down. Throw in some indirect savings. I've always argued that if you account for all of the savings in terms of conventional economic theory, taxpayers would save money rather than having to pay money. And the task in designing the program is in part to call attention to those savings by gradually claiming them for the program, which is another function of the trust fund, not just gives you a sense of entitlement, but also it gives you a place to deposit those savings rather than relying on the annual budget appropriations, which is a real iffy proposition. Okay, so I'm sure I didn't answer all of it. Defending the program once it's in place, I think that Jonathan, well, actually it was Rowan, I think, as long as we're reasonably smart in drafting that, I don't think that there's going to be a constitutional problem, because we're talking about a social welfare benefit. And government funding of a social welfare benefit is something that is well supported in the law. So I'm not worried about that. However, there are lots of legal issues that I think do require careful attention to. And particularly, what do we mean by a job guarantee? I mean, we toss that idea around, but gee, if you look at it closely, there's one thing. To guarantee, okay, your Social Security benefits were denied, you get them. But you were denied a job. Well, what job? Doing what? Paying how much? And in fact, if you look at the efforts that have been made to work that out in the Humphrey-Hawkins bill, which is widely reputed to have provided a justiciable right to work. In fact, the only justiciable right that it provided was enrollment in a quote-unquote job corps whose members would be paid a monthly stipend, and they would be available for assignment on local public service projects if local communities called upon them to do that. That's not what people think of as a job. You're hired to do something and you're paid a wage for it. You're not enrolled in a corps, provided a monthly stipend, and then you wait to get called out. So I think that figuring out how to provide a guarantee is the area where I think the legal problems are perhaps most fraught and is that I've currently been working on. In terms of economic human rights, they're already in the law. And they're in the law because American progressives put them in. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is the international bill of human rights that all members of the United Nations are legally obligated to promote, including the United States. It's in the charter. So since 1945, we have been legally obligated to guarantee employment to all our citizens. The problem is not that they're not in the law. The problem is that the law is not enforced. But that's a characteristic of human rights law. South Africans who were fighting against apartheid weren't claiming, oh, this is a right recognized in law. We're going to go to court and get it. This is a right that we have to enforce. In this instance, we have to enforce it by going into the streets. So the problem is not in getting the right into human rights law. It's in figuring out a way of enforcing the right. And that's, again, where, well, obviously street demonstrations would help, but also drafting legislation and promoting legislation also. And finally, this actually is in response to what we're talking about, and also your point about not 100 years, but now. Yeah, let's face it, it ain't going to happen in D.C. Okay? If we want to institute a right to work, where is there enough political support to legislate such a right? It ain't going to be in D.C. before or after the next elections. Even if the Democrats have the majority, some of those Democrats aren't going to go along. Well, it's in local cities, maybe states, where progressives actually are politically dominant. For the past year and a half, I've been working with other members of the National Jobs for All Coalition on New York City legislation. Public advocate Letitia James is going to sponsor it. Now that she's running for Attorney General, she's dropped it, but we've got another sponsor. I almost wished that she wouldn't get the nomination. I'm delighted to have a good Attorney General, but I think I would have preferred to have her as mayor advocating a right to work, and that, I think, was her backup plan, or at least the plan that led her to sign on to this effort to draft legislation. So it's been drafted. It's been sitting in the office of City Council, City Council's council, being vetted, but essentially waiting until the political waters settle so that our co-sponsor can introduce it. And it's a local version of H.R. 1000. Now, the problem there is, of course, as MMT theorists are very quick to point out, you got to control your currency in order to rely on MMT. Can't do it at the state and local level. Can't do it at the individual country level unless, well, they've got some notions about introducing a shadow currency. But basically, if you wanted to do it at the city or the state level, you do have to pay for it out of taxes. And so I think that it behooves us to be thinking about how we could do that. Because that's actually going to be the route to Washington, and that's going to be the immediate route, even if the 100 years plan will eventually have to be enacted in D.C.
Hi. I just want to look back to Dr. Julia's point. The thing is that the main issue with the American Constitution is that it only gives us negative rights, like Congress shall not pass any laws to do blah, blah, blah. And we need to change the way we think of rights from negative to positive duties that the government has towards us. And I see that as like a main cognitive, whatever the word is.
So let's open up and also free to people can talk about more than the job guarantee at this point.
Yes, yes. So we're gonna reopen it up. I see you, but you have conceded.
I feel like it's kind of, I don't want to get into this.
Okay, so I'm gonna start actually over here. And then next to him is Carla.
So quickly, right, because I know we don't have a whole lot of time, and I'm also mindful that most of your time has been dominated by male voices, so I'm going to try to do my brief. Basically, we do have the capacity to issue our own currencies on the local, regional, and state levels, and there are models for doing this. I'm not going to dive into any rabbit holes here, but what blockchain technology ultimately allows us to do is tell new stories of value and have a yes and proposition when it comes to the money system. So monetary pluralism is not only an imminent reality, it's here. Like, we have thousands of currencies that are not issued by central banks and regulated by governments. So we do actually have the capacity to issue our own targeted currencies, and they don't have to be financed through taxes. There are other models that are out there. So I just want to encourage the room, as people who are thinking about monetary policy from a legal perspective, to give some serious thought and consideration to how to make the most out of a pluralistic equation when it comes to one.
I'm going to follow up. There's Berkshire's money. Basically, I was just going to add something to the first point, and I think where the money goes. So I was actually thinking, I'm from Brazil, so Brazil is famous for doing the budget and the participatory budgeting process. So it'll be interesting to see how MIT kind of chime in and take advantage. I know there's a lot of going on in New York City regarding local budgeting, so that would be an interesting question, I think.
Thank you. I guess I'm really interested in the comments that Phil Harvey made about how we can get buy-in to the program and how we can kind of frame that even to appeal to a Republican audience or a wider audience. So I guess, we have to frame it as an entitlement. Like, Social Security was passed not because it was a human right. It was not really about rights, but it was like, holy shit, it's a super rich, most abundant country in the world, and we're leaving our like elderly just like poor and walking the streets. Like, this is not okay, right? So the abundance we see is completely, or the scarcity of the arguments, like the scarcity of money arguments, runs totally counter for any young person. I mean, this is like, we're beyond that now, but any young person that I speak to, they're like, that's ridiculous that we're out of money, but we're the most abundant country in the world, the most productive country in the world. So when we talk about the scarcity of Social Security or the scarcity of our abilities to fund different initiatives, then this is like a total cognitive dissonance for most people that I speak to when they're young people. So if you want to talk, about that, we say we set up a job as an entitlement, which makes it really difficult to take it away, and as part of the federal budget, like Social Security was established, et cetera. So that makes up, 80% of the federal budget, and then that makes it easier for us over the long term. And it doesn't necessarily need to be a right, but I do like the idea of backing it up with a human rights thing. In terms of trying to make it more politically attractive and making it like just easier to understand how we're going to pay for that, I mean, for most Republicans that I speak to, and in private conversations with them, I just say, look, right now we're paying people to eat chips all day in front of the TV. Why don't we pay them to take care of the kids after school so the other people could be working? And then they're like, oh, that sounds like a good idea. I'd much rather that. So I know it sounds real crass there, but that's what it feels like. Also a little bit true, and that's why people, like everyday people, they need somebody to help them with the kids out of school so they can stay at work and be productive and add to the economy. Well, these people are sitting at home watching TV and eating chips. You may as well get them a job.
I'm going to take this, we're going to open it back for some responses and then go again. I'm going to ask everyone to condense your comments, because I want to hear as many voices as I can.
Thank you, panel.
It's not for amplification, it's just for recording.
Oh, I see, okay.
So turn it on by speaking loud.
Okay, very good. I want to thank the panel, especially for the insights that you brought to the table. Sort of reminded of the speech in Julius Caesar, the fault is not in our stars, but ourselves. That is really what this is about. On the other hand, and I'm hesitant to say this since I've made my living for 40 years off of Matthews, off of Goldberg versus Kelly and Matthews versus Eldridge, which has sort of created this system of rights, is that I'm very nervous about creating these as rights. It tends to be a very much of a top-down situation. A lot, for example, sexual harassment laws, until recently, been the right of middle class women not to be sexually harassed. And filing the Supreme Court case, for example, was a bank manager type. And again, as someone who did this, as go enforce my rights. I'm basically estranged from actually participating in this, except perhaps in, you know, hearing prep. And that gets me very nervous. I mean, one of the issues, for example, in terms of trade unions is very much the idea of even the National Labor Relations Act, which was an enforcement of rights, not so much by collective action, although it's a right of collective action, but it's the right to engage in attorneys and protect my rights. And that is something I think we have to be very, very cautious about. Okay, thank you for your time.
So I'm going to open it up, but I want to pull something to the front of our minds as we have these conversations, particularly about political feasibility. I think it's really important to recognize that we are in a political moment where, and I am fiercely nonpartisan, so I say this coming from and situated as a person who's fiercely nonpartisan. We're in a political moment where it's not clear at all that the Republican Party of today has anything really meaningful to say about fiscal responsibility. That is not the political space. So as we're thinking, like, that doesn't decrease the importance of thinking of political feasibility, but just the idea of having conversations with Republicans, that's coming from a space of extreme privilege that not all of us are situated in, right? Because it's at the front of these platforms are not how are, I mean, we in an MMT space are thinking about how are we going to pay for it, but that's not what's dominating the airwaves and that's not what's dominating the politics today. What's dominating the politics today is how do they get my husband, who's from the Dominican Republic, out of this country. What's dominating the politics today is how do I not become, or you will not replace us, is what is dominating the politics today. So we do need to think about feasibility. This is actually why, some local thinking to try to push us up to the federal is really important. But there's a limit to the wisdom of trying to convince a Republican of today who has embraced that platform if you want me to stay in the room. Because if you are convincing them I didn't get off my ass and start working, F you, I'm gone. Because I said it yesterday, I stay working, right? If you are convincing them we can just, you know, we should get a job guarantee because poor people and the unemployed should be working, right? That's what they should do. Because, you know, the reason we have structural and persistent poverty is because those efforts don't ever want to do anything and they just want handouts. If that's the political strategy, that's cool, but let people know so that they can leave the room now, right? Like, because I spent a lot of time in this space that I can leave. Doesn't mean we don't need, I'm pointing at you because you're talking about political feasibility. Doesn't mean we don't need to talk about the political feasibility, but we need to think about where we want to draw those lines. Sorry, I thought that was really important to say. I want this out of my hands. Johnny, can you take a seat?
Yeah, we have about 20 minutes left in the session, so if folks want to move the conversation beyond the job guarantee, we'll share.
Sorry,
Johnny,
you can pass it to you, and behind you. And then that one's Sue. Sorry, Johnny.
I don't have much expertise. I just put it on the law, but I've been very interested in whether or not there are legal barriers to implementing a lot of these policies that we want to implement. You know, like, for example, is there a history of case law that will make it more difficult to implement it or more easy for states to sue against the federal government for implementing the job guarantee or any other progressive law? So I was wondering if you have any thoughts on that and whether or not that's Congress could pass
the law
in such a way
that meant
that.
Yes. Can you hear me?
It's not for amplification. You speak up, we're just recording you.
Oh, okay. I wanted to know if people on the panel have looked at Dennis Kucinich's National Emergency Employment Act, the NEED Act. When he was in Congress as a representative, he learned about the monetary system through the American Monetary Institute. And he put together a law for full employment, changing the monitoring system we have now. And he had it for two and a half years through the Legislative Council, so it was all vetted with all the current law. And then, of course, because he did that, my opinion, he got redistricted out of his Ohio seat. But I'm wondering if you've looked at it, because I know that they're in Real Progressive. Joe Firestone has, there's a YouTube of him going line by line through that legislation for full employment, and a lot of it he liked.
I think he keeps
So I'm going to hear you, and then I'm going to pop out here, Phil, to answer that question.
Hi, Sherry Wise. I work for the USDA. I work for the federal government, and as such, I do rulemaking from time to time. And in in the 1980s, Reagan issued Executive Order 12866 that says any legislation that costs the federal government more than that costs the economy more than $100 million a year, and it's not hard for that, to get up that high, then we have to have an economic assessment analysis done, regulatory impact analysis. And so the thing is, the reason why this is a concern to me with respect to the jobs guarantee is that part of what the economic analysis needs to do is it needs to provide a justification for why the legislation, why the rule is going to benefit society, right? And there's actually really pretty narrow criteria for that. And that criteria pretty much is market failure. So it's externalities, asymmetric information, public goods, and market power. I'm worried that if that kind of thing doesn't get maybe broadened, that might be a stumbling block, especially if you're looking at federal jobs jobs guarantee at the federal level. And I think in general it's kind of a problem. Because there's other legislation that doesn't fit into that criteria. Office of Management and Budget, they're the ones that actually do the review. They will always hone in on that. And they're coming from a very strictly neoclassical perspective. Even an institutional analysis is not gonna fly. So I think that's something that you got to think about. Administrative law at the federal level could really mess you up.
You want to talk about legal barriers as well?
There are actually three other questions. What was the name of the congressman who had the law that you were referring to?
Dennis Kucinich.
Kucinich. Okay. I'm not familiar with that, but I want to look it up. Thank you.
Great.
Is there case law? Certainly with respect to the, I can't remember your name,
Jim
pointed out, administrative law vis-a-vis granting of rights to individuals, to benefits, which is why in thinking about how to provide a job guarantee, we certainly do not want a program that is modeled on an individual application that can be either denied or granted unless the criteria are both clearly and broadly set out to include everyone. And so in drafting the legislation, we do have to take into account that. So far as the legality of the program itself as a social welfare benefit program, I don't think there's case law that's really problematic. In terms of the, who's the, and whose benefit this is for, I think it's important to remember the average wage, last wage earned by people receiving unemployment insurance benefits currently is over $20 an hour. The unemployed are not
mainly, or certainly not exclusively, the poor, oppressed population. And the involuntary part-time workers are also not that population. Yes, the discouraged workers population includes a lot of them, but not exclusively. A lot of them are middle-aged workers who dropped out. The truth is that part of the problem is that unemployment is conceived of at the top of the business cycle as a problem of poor, oppressed people. You know, and that are they lazy or is there a barrier? During a recession, of course, we get more they were thrown out of a job. It's not their fault. So I think that in framing, we can and should frame it not as these poor people need jobs, but the rates of suffering of employment over a period of time are not, you know, 5-6%, but more like 40%, 50%. Do you remember the last time you were unemployed, or a member of your family was unemployed? Did your teenage child have a summer job last year? When's the last time a relative of yours or a friend of yours was sleeping on the couch because they didn't have a job? There are ways in which this, and I thought about these particularly in trying to appeal to New York. New York's a progressive city, but there's a lot of unprogressive boroughs, or at least pieces of boroughs out there.
Not that many boroughs.
Not boroughs. There's an unprogressive borough, and there are unprogressive pieces of all the other boroughs. And the program has to be designed in a way so that the benefits are felt in those places as well, and for the benefit of the children and the relatives of people who think of themselves as hard conservatives. So I think that is what I wanted to say. Thanks.
So we've got 12 minutes. I'm going to hand this to Raul, but I want to try to get some last comments after we hear from Raul.
I just want to briefly make a point that may not be apparent to especially folks who don't have legal training in the room. There's a spectrum of ways to generate a rights system, right? You can go through the courts, you try to have, you know, certain Supreme Court justices carve out a right out of the ether and case law, etc. And then there's a legislative-driven strategy, which we're mostly talking about when it comes to the job guarantee. That's really important on these questions of judicial enforcement and things like that. I just want to make it clear that we are not pushing for at least I think most people working on the job guarantee are not asking the court to find a fundamental right. There are proposals. Bill Quigley's proposal has a constitutional amendment draft up. There are all kinds of ways to do this, but we're mostly talking about legislation. And then I just want to acknowledge Sherry's point really quick about the CBO and the OMB enemies.
OMB.
Very much aware.
OMB.
So the OMB and I'd add the CBO to that. There are plenty of regulatory assessments that will be in our way. Stephanie is very much in those conversations. People not in this room, Mark McCluskey has been mentioned, Frank Pasquale, are attacking the methodology and saying that this is not meeting the purposes it says it does. And so that's very much happening.
And I also think long-term, some of this stuff, right, like legislative responses don't just, I teach immigration law and business law. So legislative and property law, right, doesn't just mean creating new law. Sometimes it means getting rid of old crap, and so that can be a part of that as we're changing.
Three quick points. First of all, I really appreciate that we've moved past the technical confusion to the political question of how we frame these things. I think it's worth acknowledging there's two ways to talk about the politics of things like pay fors. You know, the line, there's never time to do it right, there's always time to do it again. Social Security is still on the chopping block. In addition to the racial and other problems to do with the taxpayer narrative that we should be abandoning for the sake of political solidarity with the people we should be building the coalition with, we should also consider whether, if we frame it as, well, if there's enough money, we should do it, means that if there isn't enough money, we can't do it again, and how we're actually conceding a lot to the pay for narrative, not just, you know, in certain senses of you know, immediacy, but also in terms of actually the moral claim that we're making. The second point is, one of the great things about law, for people who are not lawyers in the room, is there are multiple ways to skin a cat legally. So in terms of what Phil's talking about with the tiered job guarantee or not having a single base wage, to give some context, I see the MMT is talking about the base wage because their concern is lifting the bottom. They want the universal standard at the basic level. There might be rights for students who go to private schools, but we want to talk about public education first. And the context of the tiered wage, where I think there is room for common ground, and I'm pushing for that, my point of view, community, although I don't speak on anyone else's behalf, is things like skills, credentials, and higher education, and how we can provide premiums and sort of wage subsidies or wage boosts or ways to have a tiered wage system that is still tied to that base wage that links into things beyond merely existing wage structures, existing wage rates, or sort of preserving the power of certain unions because we have to have them on board and we think we need to. The last thing I just make a plug is I'm really, really excited to see how many people in this room. I've wanted to have a conversation about law and MMT for so long. It's amazing it's happening. We need help. Please keep it going. We need your help. We need to build this conversation. We should have more law conferences or law schools to continue this conversation. Anyone in the room, even if you're not a lawyer, please help us out. Thank you.
As you probably, I'm sure you know, both North Dakota's had a public bank for a very long time, and the city of Oakland just voted for one.
So I see your hand.
Yeah.
We'll be talking about that in the next session.
along the banking theme, I've been a banker for decades, and I'm really interested in the postal banking. I understand that it's very popular in Europe, and there's a whole group of people, some of whom may need a job guarantee, that don't have the cash flow to maintain a regular account without crazy fees and all that stuff that goes with. So how difficult would it be to implement both the public, but also the postal banking? Just wondered if we had any ideas about that.
Hands. All right, I'm going to take these two, and then we'll come back for a minute on the...
Quick question. So when you talk about jobs guarantee and tying human rights to that, we do have to remember that we live in a digital age. So a lot of jobs that we see traditionally today are going to get automated. There's going to be robots doing, you know, a lot of things like caregiving, healthcare, you name it, right? Like, it's a lot of people are going to get displaced. So how do we think about jobs in this digital age? I'm sure there's so many things we still can do. I mean, there's sky's the limit, right, for human ingenuity. So it's not a problem. But how do we evolve into that thinking? Also, tying into that, I think the right to education should also be emphasized, because whether it be higher education or even just skills training, whatever people need that they didn't have access to because of the lack of finances or just the financial freedom can now be opened up, and people can be free to pursue whatever they want. So it's hard to add that in.
I have a car. I mean, I show
the car. I want a car
too.
Here's my car. I definitely want a car.
Thank you. So I had a question regarding the political economy of MMT on municipal and state level. I know we've largely been talking about MMT and the political economy of MMT on a federal level makes sense. Federal government can spend about financial constraints, obviously state and municipal governments do have financial constraints in funding taxes. But, and I know we talked about earlier a little bit about how on a municipal and state level, kind of acknowledge that consensus or legislation is easier to make happen on a local level. And so what are the specific, but because of MMT and the political economy of MMT largely like getting towards federal legislation, so what are the, I'm very curious, especially for me, because I come from a big state, I come from Texas, and the border state, our legal system is very, very powerful and very influential. What are the legal contributions that cities and states can make in order to accommodate MMT policy?
All right, so what I'm going to do, because we're running out of time, I'm going to run across here, take a look around the room, find your friend, find the person you want to continue this conversation, the people you want to continue this conversation with, but I'll run down this row right here to give last thoughts towards
I'll
the people that we heard. Okay.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Sure, I'll just make a couple quick comments on the proposal that and first with a note that we will, I think, be diving into that more in the next panel. But to address the legal standpoint, grants are one of these mechanisms that cities can use to try to get around some of the issues without being able to issue a currency, in addition to complementary currency and other types of programs. That being said, public banks do not spend money. They lend or they invest, right? Carlos from Brazil, they have a big and complicated now public banking system there, and maybe be able to tell you a little bit more about that. But it's important to remember that it's a bank, it's not a treasury, right? And so there are some proposals for banks to lend into worker cooperatives, small businesses specifically to help create jobs, but it's a little bit more attenuated than the job guarantee type stuff that we're talking about here. With respect to postal banking, again, we'll get to that more in the next panel, but just to kind of describe the current legal terrain as I understand it, especially from experts like Marisol Rotterman, who unfortunately couldn't be here this weekend, is that there are really two proposals for postal banking at this point. One is a legislative proposal being pushed by Senator Gillibrand, which creates new powers for USPS to do certain things. Senator Warren has been quietly working out an administrative approach for some time, along with the unions, one of the postal workers unions. And that proposal is focused on providing basic financial services, but not necessarily lending, because there's a question of whether the USPS is statutory authorized to lend, as opposed to cash checks, have savings accounts, that type of basic thing. But more than that, it's
I think I'd rather talk to you individually because there are several things I'd like to respond to, but that would push us over time, but I do have responses to questions that people have asked, especially about local and state problems.
All right, so I guess I'll leave you with this thought, especially as we start pushing forward some new ideas. Again, the way we build our legal structures, right, will have formative impacts on our brain. And the ideas that we're having come from the structures that already exist. So Marisa Batterman's work is really great on the color of money and banking and how that replicates the very same racialized and gendered structures that exist. The ideas we have that we see as liberatory are mired in what the definition of freedom, be that economic or socio-political freedom, is that we're working on now. And so as we're thinking of these ideas, really engaging and interrogating, what of the existing system are we replicating? And so are we gonna wind up lifting the bottom, but keeping the bottom brown? Or are we gonna figure out how to lift the bottom and diversify all strata on the path to fewer strata? That is a core question that must be engaged when we're making the rules that structure the game. Thanks for joining us, guys.